order on. Okay, so good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231, second to the last week of school. Actually, it's the last full week. Next week is a short week, but since we only go to Wednesday next week, it's a full week for us. And today's date is November 28th. So this is the first day back after Thanksgiving. All right, so this week we're going to cover reproductive system and urinary system, do the last bit of dissection on the fetal pig in lab. And then next week is the lab practicum, both on Monday and Wednesday. And we don't need 3 hours to take a practicum next week. And also you'll have a quiz, so you got a practicum and a quiz next week. So the 7:30 class will meet at 8:30. So Monday 7:30 will meet at 8:30. The Wednesday 7:30 a.m. will meet at 8:30. So that we don't need 3 hours to take those two little tests. But the 12 o'clock class, we'll try to start right at 12 o'clock, okay? Maybe a little bit after, depending on how much time I have to spend setting up the practical exam. Okay, any questions? I don't have the date of the final exam, but I presume it's on a Monday. Is it? It's on the 12th? And what the heck is the 12th? Is that a Monday? Monday? And probably it's at 10:30, I would guess, something like that. I'll get the particulars to you. I'll probably maybe even send you a, it's on your syllabus. What was that?
10:30, 12:30.
Yeah, so it's at 10:30. Kind of funny, just worked out same as our class right here. All right, so we're going to move on to urinary system, and I hear a lot of talking. So I tell you what, should I turn up my microphone, or is it like really cool stuff that we should all know about? Cool stuff? What's the cool stuff you guys are talking about? Black Monday. Well, Black Monday. Wait a second. There's no such thing as Black Monday. Cyber Monday. Yeah, I know. I'm hearing all the deals that are going by in my headset right now, and I just punch a button and I buy them as they go by. Okay. So, all right. So, no texting, and by the way, shut up too if you're still talking. All right, thank you. So urinary system. This is going to be a pretty simple system in most regards. We got four major components of the urinary system, starting with the kidneys right here. Kidneys are about as big as your fist. You got two. If you're normal, they're on either side of the vena cava and descending abdominal aorta. And they're retroperitoneal, which means they're behind the peritoneal membrane. They're not really close to the abdominal or pelvic organs. All right, so in lab, if you want to find the kidney, you have to dissect the way through the peritoneum to find them, and they're going to be surrounded by back muscles, like, for instance, the erector spinae. They're going to have some fat around them, all right, that's just to protect them from trauma and shock. All right, so that's the first component. Second component, there's a tube that's going to take the product of the kidneys, which we call urine, from the kidneys down to the urinary bladder. That tube is a ureter, and those are bilateral as well, of course. And then you only have one urinary bladder. And then the fourth component is the urethra. That's just a tube for voiding the urinary bladder at the proper time. And on this diagram right here, can you tell if this is male or female? It's a female. How do you know? Because of his uterus right here. Okay, that's a good guess. We have a model in lab, and you should be able to tell me after lab if the model is male or female as well. But don't tell anybody if you know, have memorized it. All right, so those are the four components of the urinary system. All right, the functions of the urinary system is pretty complex. Okay, even though it produces urine, in the process of producing urine, it adjusts water volume inside your body, which then adjusts blood volume. And when you adjust the volume of your blood, guess what your body is doing? Think of your tire on your car or a balloon. If your tires are running a little flat, what do? Put air in or take air out? You put air in. Same thing for your blood pressure, right? If your blood pressure is a little low, then the kidney will place water inside your body, you won't urinate it out, and your blood pressure will go up. Under normal circumstances, if your blood pressure is too high, the kidneys will take water out of your body and place it in urine. Guess what happens to your blood pressure when you excrete water through urination? your blood pressure is going to drop. So the kidney helps regulate blood pressure. The kidney also helps regulate red blood cell production because it secretes a hormone called erythropoietin when blood oxygen concentration decreases. And then the erythropoietin is a hormone that goes to red bone marrow and stimulates red blood cell production. The kidneys can also excrete substances, toxic compounds like urea, and if you have excess salt in your body, whether it's sodium or potassium, the kidneys can excrete these ions. And if you have too much acid or hydrogen ions in your body, the kidneys can excrete those as well. So the job of the kidneys, right, is pretty extensive. Removes waste products from blood, like urea would be a good example. Helps control blood volume by long-term regulation. Regulates electrolyte levels. And when I say electrolyte, give me an example of an electrolyte. Oh, I was so fast, I couldn't even copy that. What was that? Oh, yeah, potassium. Very good. Potassium, sodium. We call these electrolytes because these are ions. They have an electrical charge on them. Since they have an electrical charge, right, your body is very electrical. Some of the basic properties of your body run by electrical currents and voltages. Right. Kidneys regulate pH, which is a measure of acidity, and it controls red blood cell production, okay, through that hormone called erythropoietin. All right, so let's take a look. Location. These are about bean shaped. They kind of look like a bean, like a kidney bean. And they're about as big as your fist. Posterior abdominal wall, either side of vertebral column, suspended by a tough connective tissue capsule. We call that the renal capsule, fat protects them. I told you all about that. And retroperitoneal. And I said what that is. If it's not making sense, go look that word up. Maybe look at retroperitoneal in Wikipedia or something, right? It just means that it's not inside the abdominal cavity. It's really outside the abdominal cavity, because we define the abdominal cavity as interior to the peritoneal membrane. All right, let's look at some gross structures of the kidney. What's a really good exam figure? This maybe isn't bad. Is this a good exam figure? Where'd it go? Rats. Here it is. Pretty good exam figure. So here is a kidney. You can see it's kind of bean-shaped. This is larger than what you have in your body, of course, because we zoomed in. So this is what produces urine. Then urine travels down the ureter to what major organ? The urinary bladder. Okay, so this apparatus right here produces urine. So the outer part of the kidney is what we call the fibrous capsule or renal capsule. And then, remember, most organs have two major divisions. There's a superficial division and a deep division. What do we call the superficial part? The cortex. So here is the renal cortex. I can see a lot of veins and arteries, red and blue blood vessels. So starting right here up toward the surface, that's the renal cortex. And everything deep, right in this region right here, is the renal medulla. So it's pretty easy to identify. The renal medulla has some triangular shaped structures and some more columnar-shaped structures in between the pyramids. And indeed, these are what we call the renal pyramids. Here's the apex. Here's the base of a renal pyramid. So where do we find renal pyramids? What part of the kidney? In the medulla, right? The renal medulla. The tip of a pyramid sort of is not a really pointed structure. It kind of is more dome-shaped. This is what we call a renal papillae. And there are places where a nephron secretes urine into this big collecting basin at the tip of every renal pyramid. This is what we call a calyx. And in particular, since this calyx is attached to only one pyramid right here, we call this a minor calyx. So be careful with that spelling, because I suppose that could be on a practicum. Calyx. All right, so where do we have? Oh, this just shows blood vessels. Okay. Where is, maybe I want to show you one that has, oh yeah, okay, here's one that shows the major parts of the kidney first, okay? So here we see the cortex, here's the medulla, These are the renal pyramids and the medulla, and then these are what we call the renal columns. So the pyramids contain nephrons, and the columns contain mostly blood vessels. Right, so blood vessels move from the cortex into the medulla and vice versa via the columns. But urine is being processed in these pyramids. The tip of a pyramid is a papillae. Here's a minor calyx, and here's a minor calyx, here's a minor calyx, where various minor calyces join together, like I see three. One, two, three minor calyces join together right here. We're going to call that a major calyx. And this membrane is pretty tough. It does not allow for exchange. So this material in a calyx is urine, and it can't be modified anymore. Urine is then going to flow into this funnel-shaped structure right in this region here. We call that the renal pelvis. And then from the renal pelvis, urine will flow into a ureter and then the urinary bladder. So you got the fibrous capsule, the cortex, a pyramid. Okay, where the blood vessels attach to the kidney, where they enter and leave, like the renal artery brings blood in, renal vein takes blood out, and where the ureter exits the kidney, right here, this is what we call the hilus, or hilum of the kidney. It's the attachment point to the rest of your body, right? So arteries and veins don't attach to the kidney anywhere. It's just only at the hilus, and there's also a renal nerve that enters right here, which is not shown on this diagram, right? But these things don't communicate with the kidney except for this one region right here. There are some spaces inside the medulla that don't contain a column, don't contain a medulla, don't contain a calyx of any form or a blood vessel. So here's one of these spaces right here and a space right here and here, and it's filled with fat. That space isn't wasted. That's what we call the renal sinus. All right, so these are just spaces inside the medulla that contain adipose tissue. All right, so that's pretty much the major parts of the kidney. What happened to my word slide right here? All right, so what did we miss? Cortex, medulla, pyramids, columns. That's good. We've covered all that kind of stuff. All right, let's move on to some questions. I have some questions for you. What's the basic building block of life? The cell. Yeah, so you should have that. What's the basic building block or the structural and functional unit? That's what I wanted to say. Structural and functional unit of life is the cell. Structural and functional unit of contraction. Yeah, muscle. But muscle is pretty complicated. We like to break it down to like the very basic structural and functional unit. And that is a sarcomere, right? So I like sarcomere, so you know, should know all the different parts of a sarcomere. What about the structural and functional unit of communication between cells? What's that called? Okay, but between neurons, the thing that allows neurons to communicate with each other, it's called a synapse. And remember, synapse has got all kinds of important parts to it, the presynaptic membrane, postsynaptic membrane, all that kind of stuff. What about for compact bone? What's the structural and functional unit for compact bone? That was the osteon, right? So here's another another structural and functional unit, and that is for urine formation. You should know the name of the structural and functional unit of urine formation. And that is the, here it is right here. What does it show on the slide? Nephron. All right, so just like the sarcomere, you had to learn a lot of individual components. You have to know some individual components of the nephron, and then also how they function. All right, so the nephron has got two main components. There are tubular elements, and then there are vascular elements. And as a matter of fact, maybe in parentheses right here, I want to say what's inside of a vascular element. What does a vascular system transport? What does your vascular system transport? You all know. I'm asking the question in maybe a way you haven't thought about. It transports what? Blood. All right, so in the vascular elements of the nephron, you're going to have blood. And what did we say the nephron produces? Urine. So the tubular elements don't contain blood. They contain, what do they contain? Okay. They contain urine, right? But also Okay, so a precursor to urine, and a precursor to urine is called filtrate. All right, so those are the fluids that you'll find in tubular elements. Maybe I'll save this right away. Okay, and blood in vascular elements. All right, so here are all of the different components that you have to know. Let's start by looking at these tubular elements. And I think I'm just going to start to draw this on the board, hopefully. Okay, a tubular element contains filtrate or urine. Oh, that's not bad. That's a good marker. Okay, so this first little collecting basin, plasma is going to filter out of the blood into this little collecting basin right here. And this is what we call Bowman's capsule. And Bowman's capsule is going to be located in the medulla of the kidney. And it's going to collect a watery fluid from blood. And then this watery fluid is going to be transported into this tubule right here. And what can you tell me about the nature of that tubule that I just drew? Is it straight? How would you talk about something that has all those twists and turns on it? What are you going to call that? Convoluted. Yeah. And since it's close to Bowman's capsule, we're going to call this the proximal convoluted tubule. And I think I'm just going to abbreviate it. PCT, proximal convoluted tubule. And what's the name of the fluid in the proximal convoluted tubule? We're going to call it filtrate. It's not been processed yet into urine. After it goes through the nephron, the excretion from the nephron will be called urine, but we're not there yet. Okay, then this tube goes way down into the medulla of the kidney, and it comes back up. This thing is called the loop of Henle, and it's got two divisions. All right, it's got a descending part and an ascending part. So we're going to call this the descending loop of Henle. And over here is the ascending loop of Henle. And what's the name of the fluid that's in the loop of Henle? It's not urine yet. So you got two choices. It could be blood or it could be filtrate. It's filtrate. Okay. And then it goes back up into the cortex. And guess what we got right here? Another convoluted tubule. But it's not the proximal convoluted tubule. This is going to be distal convoluted tubule, DCT, and then, oh, what's the name of the fluid inside the distal convoluted tubule? It's still being processed, so it's filtrate once again, and then it goes into the collecting duct. Here's a collecting duct, and then these distal segments of the collecting duct, this is where you have urine. It's no longer being processed. This fluid has been processed by this first part of the nephron, okay, and the collecting duct then goes to a tip of a renal pyramid or a papillae into a minor calyx, and then urine flows into a major calyx and then a pelvis and then down a ureter into a urinary bladder. And then how does it get out of the urinary bladder outside your body? What's the tube that takes it out of the bladder, urinary bladder? Is the urethra, okay, so urethra. All right, so here's part. What part of the nephron is this right here? What are the two parts of a nephron? You got tubular elements and vascular elements. What kind of elements are these? These are the tubular elements that contain filtrate, okay, or urine. All right, vascular elements. Let's draw these in. All right, so here you got a blood vessel. Ooh, that's nice. I can see that. Here's a blood vessel that is going to enter Bowman's capsule. So this is what we call the afferent arteriole. Afferent arteriole, taking blood into Bowman's capsule. And then there's going to be a capillary inside Bowman's capsule. What's the function of a capillary? Exchange. So there's fluid that can leave this capillary bed and go into Bowman's capsule. This capillary bed in here just is just a random arrangement of capillaries that are very leaky. A lot of water leaks out. A lot of electrolytes leak out. but no proteins. There shouldn't be proteins moving across the membrane. There should be no red blood cells because they're way too big. Okay, if there are proteins leaking out of this capillary right here, or red blood cells, then guess what condition you have? You have nephritis. Okay, nephritis, which could be a sign of kidney failure, for instance. Right, so only small molecules should leak out. Right, then blood will, I didn't tell you what the name of this capillary is. It's got a special name because it's so leaky, it's called the glomerulus. All right, so that maybe I'll spell out, glomerulus. So I think you should say that out loud. I can't say your name out loud because I'm recording, but I could point my finger at somebody. Okay, who's looking? Ah, you're looking at me. Okay, say that word out loud.
Glomerulus?
Yeah, glomerulus. Say it out loud a bunch of times so that it's easy to spell. Once you get the swing of it, it's not too bad. Okay, congratulations. Glomerulus, and what the heck is a glomerulus? What is it really? It's a capillary. As a matter of fact, I'm going to say capillary number one, right here. All right, then blood flows out of this capillary. Usually, when blood flows out of a capillary, where does it go to? You got artery, capillary, what? Vein. Usually that's the case. But in the kidney, that's not quite the case. This right here is another arteriole. What's the function of an arteriole in your understanding? What does an arteriole do? An arteriole takes blood to a capillary. But here is an arteriole. This is what we're going to call the efferent arteriole. Right? But and it, what's the job of an arteriole? Take blood to a capillary. So you know what? In the nephron, there are two capillaries. There's one inside, Bowman's capsule, and then there's another capillary bed, right, that surrounds all of the tubular elements of the capillary. It just surrounds them. And since they're surrounding all the tubular elements of a capillary, we call these the peritubular capillaries. Well, this marker was doing good. PC. Here, I might need somebody's shirt to kind of get the flow of this marker again. No, just kidding. Okay, peritubular capillaries. So, peritubular capillaries are capillary bed number what? Number two. What do we call a vascular system with two capillary beds back to back? It's unusual, but you should probably have on the tip of your tongue maybe three of these circulations in your body. What do we call a circulation, a circulatory system that has two capillary beds back to back? Glomerulus number one, peritubular capillaries number two. Okay, that's a portal system, fantastic. So the kidney has a portal system, but what are two other places in your body that have a portal circulation? The liver, the hepatic portal vein, right, bringing blood from intestines to the liver. That's a portal system. So there are capillaries in the intestines, capillaries in the liver. Two capillaries back to back. What's another one? Talked about it twice. Yeah, the hypothalamo-hypophyseal portal vessel. Ah, it's a mouthful, but where is it? Between what two places? Hypothalamo is the hypothalamus. And the hypophysis is another name for the pituitary gland, right? So it's a blood vessel that goes from the hypothalamus to the anterior pituitary that carries these releasing factors to the anterior pituitary. So now you know three. I can't remember for sure, but it sounds like a good one. But it's just kind of like if this was a cumulative exam, that for sure would be on there, right? Okay, and then from this capillary, right, then blood goes to the renal vein, and then inferior vena cava, then back to the right atrium. Okay, so that's the nephron. All right, so in this blue element right here, what's the name of the fluid in this tube right here? Filtrate. And what's the name of the fluid over here in this collecting duct? Urine. All right, so something has to happen to take filtrate and Make urine out of it. Yeah. Collecting duct. Collecting duct. You know what? As I draw that, maybe I should have put, maybe I'll put this diagram up on the slide for you to see. I'll make it a little bit bigger. But as you see, okay, from the diagram that's in your book, my diagram is better. Okay, it's easier to see, at least in my eyes, especially if you draw it out. Okay, so in order to produce urine, there are three processes that your body uses. The first process, okay, come on, pen. The first process is fluid that's in your blood inside the glomerulus leaks out, and it goes into Bowman's capsule. This is number one. And this happens just by size. And probably you've used or you had somebody use this process this morning when you made some coffee. What's the process that you use to make coffee?
Filtration.
Yeah, filtration. So you put a bunch of water and coffee grounds. I have no idea why that got, oh, it went away again. It got really loud. Okay, and on one side of the filter paper you get all the big junk, and then on the other side of the filter paper you get all the stuff that you can drink really easily, right? Okay, unless you're French, I guess you just have breakfast and drink at the same time, right? You don't use filter paper. Sorry if you're French. Okay, so this step right here is what we call filtration. Number one, filtration. Let's put that right here. Okay, and where does filtration take place? Inside Bowman's capsule. All right, here's something else. This structure that has a vascular element and a tubular element combined, which means it has a glomerulus inside Bowman's capsule, sometimes we call that the renal corpuscle. So filtration is something that happens inside the renal corpuscle. Do I still have my micro? Oh, there it is. Kind of flaky. It might be bouncing around. Right here. That's the renal corpuscle. So what are the two components of the renal corpuscle? Yeah, you got glomerulus. And what kind of element is that? That's a vascular element, right? That's a capillary. And the second component is Bowman's capsule. All right, so don't get capsule confused with corpuscle. And then there's the fibrous capsule on the outside of the kidney, so there's a lot of C's in this particular part of the class. All right, filtration. Where did this fluid start, and where did it end up? Where did this fluid that's being filtered, where did it start? It started in the blood. And where did it end up? In the filtrate. So filtration is the movement of fluid and solutes. Solutes are just the particles dissolved in water, right, that were in the filtrate, or that were in blood and ended up in the filtrate. So anything that's small. So let's give you an example of some of these molecules. How about H2O, that's a small molecule. I like that one. What is H2O? All right, you guys are almost ready for a physiology class. Just a couple more weeks. But take your chemistry class first. All right, H2O is water. All right, some other compounds. All right, for instance, like Na. Does anybody know what Na stands for? It's an abbreviation. Sodium, right, and potassium, abbreviated K from their Latin names. Natrium and kalium. And then what about this? C and water. CH2O. What the heck is that? And then I'm going to maybe put that in parentheses and put an N right there. So this is repeating unit over and over and over again. That is a carbon hydrate. What's a common name for carbon hydrate? Yeah, carbohydrate. That's a sugar. So sugars will end up in the filtrate, and if they stay in the nephron, where do they end up? They end up in the urine. But what is a carbohydrate something good to have in your body, or should you excrete it? Is it harmful? You need it because that's what mitochondria use to make ATP, right? So you don't want any carbohydrate ending up in the urine, right? So that would be a huge problem if that were to happen. That happens with a certain class of patients. What kind of people excrete, say, glucose in the urine? That's a carbohydrate. That would be diabetes mellitus. And so that's a pretty prevalent disease process, really unfortunate. Has to be controlled, otherwise it's a fatal process. Okay, so we got to figure out some way to get that glucose back. All right, so not only good things, but also some bad things are filtered, like urea. That's toxic, right? So that is how your body gets rid of urea from your... That's one of the reasons, one of the ways. All right, so we have a lot of water, right? There's so much water that's being filtered that if you lost that from your body, you would dehydrate and die just within a couple minutes. So that water would end up in the urine. So there's another process that takes helpful substances that you need to maintain health in your body, like glucose and water and the proper levels of salt, take them from a tubular element, like this convoluted tubule right here, and places it back into the blood. In particular, what's the name of this vascular element right here? It's surrounding the tubes, so this is the peritubular capillary. All right, so this process, number two, I'm just going to put a two right here so the diagram doesn't get too messy. Number two is what we call tubular, because it's on a tube, reabsorption. So in this particular case, water is being resorbed back into the blood. Glucose is being resorbed, placed back into the blood, all right, so that you're not throwing that energy away. You don't want any glucose in the urine. If there is glucose in the urine, that would be like going to the gas station, filling up your gas tank, and then taking an ice pick and putting a hole into the gas tank, and what would happen to gas then? Well, then it would just dribble right out of the gas tank, right? You want to hold on to that energy. So glucose should be 100% resorbed in the tubes. All right, so tubular reabsorption. Which way does material move for tubular reabsorption? Is it blood to filtrate or filtrate to blood? Filtrate to blood, so it gets placed back in your body. Tubular reabsorption, I left the cap off my marker again, is filtrate to blood. And what's the relationship to tubular filtration? What's the relationship between reabsorption and filtration? What's a good way of thinking about it? Which way are they going? Opposite directions. Yeah, just think in terms of opposite directions. Filtration is blood to filtrate, but tubular reabsorption is filtrate to blood. There must be I have no idea why the microphone is acting this way. Okay. All right, so that's two processes. The third process is that in the step of filtration, not every harmful substance that's in the blood gets filtered. Some remains in the efferent arteriole, and your body wants to get rid of it. And so it can take things that are in the blood, like peritubular capillaries, right, and stick them into a tube, like the proximal convoluted tubule. This is step number three, right here. And step number three, maybe I'll put it right here, I got some room. Step number three is called tubular secretion. So the dot shows what tube the material starts with. The tip of the arrow shows what tube it ends up in. All right, so where does this material start? In blood or filtrate? It starts in the blood, and where does it end up? In filtrate. So harmful substances like urea and excess salt and excess acid, like hydrogen ions right here, will end up in filtrate, right, which then will end up in urine and you'll excrete them from your body. Right, so tubular secretion is from blood to filtrate. Okay, we'll spend a little bit of time in lab going over that once again, because this is going to be your last quiz in lab after the practicum. Okay, understanding the nephron. So knowing the components, knowing the vascular components, the tubular components, and the three processes that produce urine. Okay, just three processes. So that's pretty easy to do that. So in your book, you have a nice diagram. Let's look at the slide. We see that there are two kinds of nephrons. There are cortical nephrons that work day in and day out, and then there's some juxtamedullary nephrons. The juxtamedullary nephron has a loop of Henle that goes way down into the medulla of the kidney, and this one is very special because it helps make concentrated urine so that when you're dehydrated in your body, the kidneys still excrete urea and other harmful compounds, but it spares as much water as possible. So when the juxtamedullary nephrons are working, it makes a very small volume of urine that is highly concentrated in solutes. All right. Well, the cortical nephrons right here make a dilute kind of urine, right? And that helps the excretion of water. So when you have too much water in your body, the medullary nephrons are working. When you're dehydrated, the juxtamedullary nephrons are mostly doing their job. All right, so you can see all of these different arterioles right here. And we have some good drag and drop exercises to help you label this nephron that I'll show you in lab. Okay, so what's the structural and functional unit of urine formation in the kidney? It's the nephron. What are the two main domains? What are the two main regions of a nephron? Or what two main elements make up a nephron? Vascular elements and tubular elements, right? Vascular contains blood, tubular contains either filtrate or urine, depending on which one it is. All right, so I don't think I'll write those on the board because here I have it in your lecture notes. Tubular elements, starting with Bowman's capsule, okay, and then proximal convoluted tubule, the loop of Henle, ascending descending limb, distal convoluted tubule, and collecting duct. Those are the tubular elements. The vascular elements, remember, that's a portal system. You have an afferent arteriole, capillary bed number one, what we call the glomerulus. Then an efferent arteriole takes blood to the peritubular capillaries, right? And the peritubular capillaries in the juxtamedullary nephron are called the vasa recta, but they're basically just peritubular capillaries. And then from there, the blood flows into the renal vein through various blood vessels. So let's take a look at some blood vessels that make up the kidney. Where are these at? Maybe this is a good slide. Ah, yeah, this is pretty good. All right, so here we see the renal artery bringing blood into via the hilum of the kidney, and I see it bifurcates. Right, so that after that first bifurcation, we call that a segmental artery. All right, and then after a segmental artery, right, then you have the arteries that go through the columns. And so we're going to call those the interlobar, because the pyramid, sometimes we call those lobes of the kidney. And then as it moves up to the base of the kidney right here, these are what we call the arcuate, both the artery and vein. The artery is red, the vein is in blue. And then the arteries then project up into the cortex, and we call these the cortical radiate arteries and veins. All right, so you should probably know how blood flows through the kidney. And off of the cortical radiate artery right here is the afferent arterioles. So let me show you a picture of where those afferent arterioles are. Here's probably a pretty good picture. All right, so here's a cortical radiate artery, and then coming off a cortical radiate artery is the afferent arteriole. And what do we call this structure right here inside Bowman's capsule? That's the glomerulus, that's a capillary. But remember, there are three kinds of capillaries in your body. They're continuous, and then they're fenestrated, and then the really, really super leaky ones were the sinusoids. These are the intermediate kind. These are fenestrated capillaries. They have like windows that a lot of fluid can move through, right? And then here's the efferent arteriole bringing blood to peritubular capillaries. Oh, and look on this diagram. It's got the three processes that will convert or process filtrate into urine. You've got filtration, resorption, and secretion. Okay, so cortical radiate artery right there. Let's look at the structure of a renal corpuscle. So here's a renal corpuscle, which is the glomerulus that's inside Bowman's capsule. And this kind of resembles a serous membrane. What can you tell me about a serous membrane? Where do you find a serous membrane? It's lining a cavity that's what? Open to the outside world or not open to the outside world? Not open to the outside world, like the pericardial cavity, the pleural cavity, the peritoneal cavity have serous membranes. And how many divisions does a serous membrane have? It's got three. There is one division that's right on the organ, like the visceral pericardium is right on the surface of the heart, and then the fibrous pericardium is part of the parietal pericardium. What do you have between the visceral, which is right on the heart, and the parietal pericardium? You have fluid, right? Serous fluid. Well, I can use that model to think of Bowman's capsule right here. All right, so here is just a nice simple squamous epithelium. This is what we call the parietal layer. This would be like, for instance, the part that's right on the thoracic cage of the parietal pleural membrane. Okay, and then notice that it's continuous with cells that line and cover the capillaries. This would be like the visceral division of a serous membrane. So this is the visceral layer of the glomerular capsule. And what do you have in between the visceral and parietal? You have like the serous fluid, but the serous fluid in Bowman's capsule is actually called filtrate. Okay, and that fluid can move through, right, from blood into Bowman's capsule, because look at all these big spaces, right, on the visceral layer of Bowman's capsule right here. So these cells are not continuous. So let's see if we can take a closer look. All right, so here is the glomerular capillary. And so these are what we call podocytes, because all of these little processes reminded somebody of little feet sticking out, so these are called foot processes. Podo just means foot. And there are big spaces between the foot processes. And the capillaries have big pores. Remember, we call those fenestrations. So this readily allows small molecules to leave the blood and enter Bowman's capsule. And between the foot processes, these are what we call filtration slits. All right, so that doesn't impede the flow of small molecules either. Right, so fenestrations or pores. So that's what it looks like. Here's a nice scanning electron micrograph of a blood vessel covered with these podocytes, and you can see all the filtration slits. I don't know if I see any fenestrations, but I certainly see the filtration slits between the podocytes. Right, and when fluid moves out of the capillary into the space right here, right, what is this space outside of these podocytes? That is inside Bowman's capsule. And the material is what? Filtrate, because it's filtered out of these capillaries. Okay. Oh, here's a pretty good illustration of the filtration membrane. Okay, so the filtration membrane, just like the respiratory membrane in an alveolus, you've got the capillary endothelium, but you have these big pores because it's a fenestrated capillary. And then you have a basement membrane that's really, really thin. And then you have the filtration slits between the foot processes and the podocytes. And so this would be filtrate inside Bowman's capsule, and this would be the fluid part of blood. The fluid part of blood is what we call plasma, right? So plasma will leak right out of the circulatory system into Bowman's capsule. All right, so this is filtrate. And what does filtrate eventually become? It eventually becomes urine, and it seems like a pretty complicated process, but how many steps are necessary to process filtrate into urine? There are three. I see number one right here, which is filtration based on the size of these pores, right? Then you have tubular resorption, and tubular secretion are the other two. All right, and you should know which way they go between the blood and filtrate. That's pretty good. All right, some other little factors. Here we see a renal corpuscle with a glomerulus inside Bowman's capsule. Oh, and what is this tube right here leading out of Bowman's capsule? That's a proximal convoluted tubule. We got some good models of that in lab. Okay, well, here we have proximal convoluted tubule, descending limb, ascending limb, distal convoluted tubule, and look where this distal convoluted tubule goes. It goes right between the afferent and efferent arteriole. It passes right through here. All right, so here is the distal convoluted tubule, and it's got a special couple components to it. Okay, these cells that make up the wall of the distal convoluted tubule, sometimes we call these the macula densa cells. Right? And then in the wall of the afferent arteriole, we see some other special cells right here. These are what we call granular cells, or sometimes juxtaglomerular cells. So this is a special apparatus. It's called the juxtaglomerular apparatus. It helps adjust blood pressure. So it can adjust the amount of urine that's being produced. All right, so these cells right here can release a hormone called renin. And renin is an enzyme that will help increase blood pressure when your blood pressure starts to go too low. And in physiology class, we learned something about that mechanism. Right? Renin converts something called angiotensinogen into something that becomes active, right? Which is going to raise your blood pressure. All right. These cells over here, the macula densa cells, can sense the concentration of salts that are in the distal convoluted tubule. And they can then send a signal, okay, to the JG cells or the granular cells to release renin, which again will help adjust blood pressure. All right, so I want you to know where this juxtaglomerular apparatus is. All right, it's right at the entrance to Bowman's capsule, right between the afferent arteriole and efferent arteriole. Right, so here is the juxtaglomerular apparatus. You got the JG cells that secrete renin when blood pressure falls. The macula densa, right, monitor solute concentration or the saltiness in urine, and it can signal the JG cells, right, to secrete renin when solute concentration or blood volume declines. What's going to happen to blood pressure when blood volume declines? What happens if you have your tire on your car and you take air out of the pressure of your car? What happens to the pressure inside that tire? It goes down, right? So that's what the macula densa cells realize, right? When blood volume decreases, then it's going to cut down on the production of urine so that you retain fluid, so that maintains blood pressure. The mesangial cells inside that area, I'll point them out to you. I don't think anybody has a good idea of why they're there. All right, so these are the mesangial cells, right, within space in between the different tubes of the glomerulus. So you might be interested later on to learn something about those when somebody figures that out. All right, so that's the juxtaglomerular apparatus. But the take-home message is, what's the job of the juxtaglomerular apparatus? It helps maintain what? It helps maintain blood pressure, right? And why do you need blood pressure? to make blood flow from one part of your body to another. So blood will flow based on a concentration or a pressure gradient. It will flow from high pressure to low pressure. So if your pressure drops too much, then you won't have blood flowing through different parts of your body, okay, which can happen because right now you're sitting down, and when you stand up, your blood pressure is going to drop. And if it drops too much, what's going to happen to you? Yeah, it lights out. You'll pass out, right? So it's important to maintain adequate blood pressure in your body. Okay, so that pretty much is the urinary system. Okay, well, what I want to do, I think right now, oh no, we're not quite over, almost over. Urinary system. Here is the urinary bladder. All right, so that holds urine till the proper time of voiding. So here's a ureter coming down, emptying into the urinary bladder right here. This area, which is kind of smooth, it has a couple ridges to it. This is what we call the trigon. The trigon is between the two orifices for the ureters and the internal orifice of the urethra. Here's the trigon. And usually, when you have a tube entering an organ or leaving an organ, you have a sphincter, which is what? What's a sphincter? Circular muscle, right? Circular, smooth muscle. And when it contracts, it acts like a valve. It prevents flow from the organ into the tube, right? But there's really no sphincter right here. It's just how the ureter attaches to the urinary bladder. It puts a little kink in the ureter. And if you have a straw and you're sipping like a drink or something from the straw and then you put a kink in the straw, what happens? You can't really sip through the straw anymore, right? So urine really doesn't move retrograde from the bladder back up into the ureter and then back up into the kidney because there's a little kink right here that prevents that retrograde flow. And I've never heard of anybody really having anatomical problems with that kink, like for instance with esophageal reflux disease, right? That can be a very common problem. But urine really only goes from kidney to ureter into the urinary bladder, right, because of that kink right there. Now notice, you see a kink right here with the urethra leaving the bladder. There's no kink. So guess what happens to urine in the bladder? It just has a straight shot out of the body. But fortunately here, we do have some sphincters. Okay? There is an internal and external urethral sphincter. When these contract, right, that occludes the flow of urine from the bladder. The internal sphincter right here is smooth muscle. That's under autonomic control. And the external right here is voluntary. It's part of the urogenital diaphragm. Sometimes we call it the perineum. There's some skeletal muscles here that we didn't really learn in lab. There's like a coccygeneus. Guess what that's associated with? It's the coccyx, right? So it goes, that's where it inserts into the coccyx. So you have these two. When this one relaxes right here, that gives you your urgency to void the bladder, okay? And then you voluntarily cause this one to relax. All right, so this would be a good example of a female urinary system right here. Do I have a male urinary system? Oh, I do have a male urinary system. Here's a male urinary system. Okay, it has the trigon. Here's the urinary bladder. Ureter is coming into it. Here is the urethra. Of course, the male urethra is a lot longer. And as a result of that, males rarely have a urinary tract infection or a urinary bladder infection because it takes bacteria a lot of time to work their way up through the urethra. But for females, right, it's a much more, how far away is it? Much more common problem. Oh, it just went slide over the other way. Okay. Urinary bladder infections are much more common for females because the urethra is very short. Right. What could be one way to help prevent bladder infections? Just by removing material from the bladder, drinking a lot, and just flushing bacteria out of the bladder. So bladder infections are more common when somebody's dehydrated and not voiding routinely. All right, so in the male, okay, here is the internal urethral sphincter right here. Here's the external way down over here. Usually it's the internal sphincter that is doing most of the work for people. And then here is the prostate gland. So notice that the urethra goes right through the prostate gland into the penis. And the prostate gland is actually part of the reproductive tract in the male. So in the male, the urinary tract and reproductive tract form together. But in the female system, which I can't show on this slide, okay, they're always separate. But what you see on this slide is just the urinary tract. We'll get to the next chapter in just a little bit. Okay, on this slide right here, I see an organ that in male, of course it's males, can form, become cancerous pretty fairly often. And as a matter of fact, all right, we talked about a process that will affect everybody, okay, way back when. What kind of disease process will affect everybody, but especially females, if you're lucky enough to live old enough? What was this process called? And what organ system did it involve? And this is really rare because, for instance, if there's a cold going around or a flu or something, is everybody in this room going to catch that cold? No, we're going to have some resistance because we're a very diverse group. All right, but this one process, these two processes that I'm thinking about are pretty strange because everybody will have to deal with this if you live long enough. And the one process we talked about, and I'll give you a hint, had to do with bones. What process that we all have to deal with regarding our bones? And that is osteoporosis, right? Females are more susceptible than males, but everybody will undergo that. Typically, if your bones are big and strong as a young adult, you're more protected from osteoporosis, but if you have thinner bones, then you're going to be more susceptible to it, whether you're male or female. Okay? Here's another process, right? And this is particular to males because only males have a prostate. If males are lucky enough to live old enough, they're going to have some form of prostate disease, right? Pretty much guaranteed. This prostate will get bigger as time goes on. It will grow bigger and bigger and bigger. And when it does, it's going to occlude the urethra right here. So by the time you're in your 70s or 80s, you're going to have trouble voiding the urinary bladder when that happens. Now, the prostate can get big for two reasons. One reason is what we call benign prostatic hypertrophy. Just means it gets bigger all by itself, and it's not necessarily dangerous, right? It still functions properly. But a second condition is that when it turns cancerous, these cells will grow and proliferate and occlude the urethra as well. Now, the trouble with cancer is then that some of these cells can break away from the prostate and end up in bone or the brain or liver and start to grow there and then push the brain aside, or bones will degrade the bone because the prostate's not nearly as strong as bone. Okay, and that certainly can be a lethal condition. So that is something that every male will have to deal with as they get older and older and older. And it's kind of a tricky diagnosis because sometimes it's a benign process, but sometimes it's a very life-threatening process, which is cancer. And that can be a tricky diagnosis to make. Now, when somebody has prostatic cancer, let's look at some of the side effects. Look how close the prostate gland is to this thing right here. What is this thing? Yeah, the internal urethral sphincter. So that when somebody has prostate cancer, right, the surgeon really doesn't have any choice but to take out the prostate, this segment of the urethra, as well as damage the internal urethral sphincter. So one of the consequences would be what? What we call incontinence, right, after that kind of surgery. Right, as a result. But what can be a saving grace? What else do you have? External urethral sphincter right here. Right? And this actually is important to not only males, but females. Females don't have a prostate, but females, right, when you're pregnant, it can damage this external urethral sphincter, right, to where females might experience incontinence as well. So what can you do? What can you do to help prevent osteoporosis? That is a blast from the past. Three important things. Okay, diet. The two components of diet is what? Have proper calcium in your diet and vitamin D to help you absorb that calcium, but that's not going to do it. What else do you have to do? This is why people hate this class. Hate it. You have to exercise as well, right? Because when you stress a bone, it gets stronger. Just like when you stress your mind, guess what happens to it? It gets stronger as well, right? You exercise a muscle, it gets stronger. Exercise a bone, it gets stronger. All right, so to help prevent incontinence in females, and even if somebody's had a prostatectomy, is to exercise these muscles. And you might want to just, everybody should just do these. We should actually do these before class, because everybody's, one way or another, chances are, is going to experience incontinence. It's called a Kegel exercise, which is what? Exercising the muscles of the perineum right here. Okay? And maybe you could do a Google search on Kegel exercises, but it's just contracting these muscles to work as a nice backup for this internal urethral sphincter as it gets lazy, as we get older. Okay, so I know you guys are asking me this question. I hear it coming through. My Karnak hat is on. And the question I'm hearing is, well, gee whiz, that prostate cancer doesn't sound really good, or the benign prostate disease doesn't sound really good. We know how to protect ourselves from osteoporosis. How do you protect yourself from prostate disease? Okay, now this is where people don't hate me so much, but it's the same as for anything else in your body. What do? Diet and exercise protects you from prostate disease. So low-fat diet, okay, and then exercise. But what kind of exercise? Not muscle exercise, but exercise that works on the prostate specifically is what? You're too shy to say. Is ejaculation, okay? It helps protect the prostate. So in that case, it's probably not so, diet and exercise is not always so bad. Okay, so that is, in the urinary system. Here is the reproductive system in the female. Here is the urinary system. Here is the outside of the body. Always separate, right, to prevent reproductive system infections, right? And in the male, you can see that right here, right, this is where the vas deferens joins the urethra. So from this point on, the urethra is part of the urinary system as well as the reproductive system in the male. Not such a big problem, because the urethra is a lot longer in the male. So it's more difficult for bacteria to make their way all the way up into the bladder or into the reproductive organs, especially the testes over here. Okay, so that's all I've got to say about urinary system. So that leaves reproductive system for this class. All right, so reproductive system contains both the male and female reproductive systems. I got some questions for you, though, before we start talking about the reproductive system right here. And so it looks pretty complicated, right? So here's a picture of a male reproductive system. Here is a picture of the female reproductive system, one typical kind of picture that we see. All right, looks drastically different, right? Okay, so I've got a question. What's the function of the reproductive system? Okay, I hear reproduce. That's a pretty good stab, but you guys are pretty much incorrect in that. Okay? And because it's, why is it so complicated? Because some organisms, like a sea anemone or a typical kind of polyp like a hydra, they'll just grow a little sea anemone on their side, and as it grows bigger, that little sea anemone is going to drop off and it's going to be another organism right next to the mom and pop organism. All right, so why is it that we don't just like grow a little baby off our side, and then when it gets to be big enough, it just doesn't separate and start living on its own? Okay, that I want you to think about. And the organs are so complicated, right? Females have a vagina, uterus, ovaries. Males have, what did they have? Penis, testes, totally different. Endocrine system is totally different. Females have estrogen, progesterone. Males have testosterone. Why is there such complexity and difference between the sexes? And another question I have is, which is easy to answer, sort of, on some levels. How many sexes are there? Okay, there's basically two sexes. Some people say three. Okay, well, I think of like two, but you're probably kidding me. But anyway, why are there two sexes? How come there aren't really three or four or five or six sexes? What is the function of the reproductive system that means that two sexes are fine for whatever it's doing? All right, so I want you to think about what it's doing in there. And what else is another interesting thing to think about? You know, there's twins. There can be identical twins born at the same time. They have all the physical, similar kinds of characteristics. But have you ever heard of identical twins being born, but maybe born by 10 or 15 years apart, or even 1 or 2 years apart? Is it possible for you to have an identical twin from your mom and dad, but separated by 5 years or 10 years? Is that possible? And the answer is, yes, it's possible. Okay, it's definitely possible, but what are the chances of that happening? They're just so astronomically high that it's probably never, ever happened in the history on this planet, and if there's life on other planet that kind of is similar to ours anywhere in the universe, it probably has never happened just because the odds of it happening is so low. So that's kind of a hint as to what the function of the reproductive system is in people. Okay? So the clue to that is, I don't know if anybody went to the USC game over the weekend. You went into the Coliseum, and there could be, let's just say there were 1 million people in the Coliseum. And if you looked around the whole Coliseum, did you see another you in there? How many yous are there? No, there's only one you, unless you have identical twins. Huh? Like Y-O-U. How many U's are there? Oh, you're thinking E-W-E? No, Y-O-U. How many U's are there? There's only one U, okay? And basically that's a hint as to what the function of the reproductive system is, okay? Which explains all of that complexity of all the anatomy and endocrinology and neurology is different between the two different sexes. Okay. So think about that, and we'll start talking about reproductive system next time. Sign-in sheet is going around.